Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, everybody. My name's Ed, and I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsorship, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink or a mood-altering chemical since January 5th of 1971, and for that I'm extremely grateful. We're going to be talking about forgiveness today, and I'm not here as an expert on forgiveness. I don't think I have a direct line on forgiveness, but I know this. That it kills more people in AA and Al-Anon than anything I've ever seen. And what am I talking about? The inability to forgive. Resentment is the number one destroyer of our fellowship. And I've had some experiences in my life, and from time to time people ask me to share about my experience with forgiveness, and that's what I'm here to do today. First, what I want to do is take a minute. And I would like to take a minute and ask you just to close your eyes and ask the God of your understanding into this room. I would also ask that you take a moment and any of the garbage you brought in here with you, push it outside the door right now. Any of your unwillingness to forgive, push it out the door right now. Just close your eyes and do that for a minute. Let's have a moment of silence for the God of your understanding. Thank you. It's kind of odd, but I would be remiss without talking about things that are going on in New Orleans and Louisiana and Alabama. Boy, if you want to see inability to forgive and out-of-place egos making comments on things they have no idea about, turn on the TV. You know, just amazing. Just amazing. So let us take another moment of silence for those people who are having disasters beyond our wildest imaginations, most of us that I know anyway, and especially for our fellowship of men and women and our programs, for those who no longer have a meeting place to go, no longer can call their sponsors, no longer has any connection like that. Let's take a moment of silence for that. Thank you. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, on page 62, it says, selfishness, self-centeredness, that is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, and self-seeking, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation. We invariably find that at some point in the past, we have made decisions based on self that later put us in a position to be hurt. But this is the paragraph I really include in forgiveness. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves. And the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. It doesn't say it gives us a bad day. It says it kills us. God makes that possible, and there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. Many of us have had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them, even though we would have liked to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. First, this is the how and the why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. We decided hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal. We are the agents. He is the father. We are his children. It goes on to say in the next paragraph, when we took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer, being all powerful. He provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such footing, we became less and less interested in our own little plans and designs. And at the end, it says, there's a great line, it said, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. Now, I read all that to read you the next line. We are now at step 3. How many of us had that down before we moved to step 3? Some of you read this today like it was new information. You've been around for a long time. But understanding that selfish and self-centeredness in the way I think about things is my problem. And it certainly is my problem in forgiveness. I had a situation that I started very early in life, and I call it my 299 to 1 theory. I could walk into a room with 300 people, 299 could turn around to me and say, Ed, you're the best. We love you. And one could go, jerk. Guess who I remembered? And thought about later that day, that night, and passing thoughts from then on forever. Now, the problem with that is there were 299 wonderful things happening right there, and I missed them all. You see, if you view life the way I viewed life, that causes trouble. It also makes you drink. One of the reasons I love to drink is part of the effects of alcohol for me is it made it not matter so much. Make it not matter so much. When I talk about forgiveness, my first forgiveness I have to talk about is forgiveness of a God of my misunderstanding. Isn't that a strange term? Misunderstanding. But that's what I got to talk about because I've learned through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that the God of my understanding today is nowhere near what I used to think about God. And it was my misunderstanding. I hated God. So in my own weird way, I had to forgive the God of my misunderstanding. That make any sense to you? When I was about 10 years old, I had a cousin, Linda. And if there was anybody ever close to God, it was Linda. Linda did everything perfectly. She looked wonderful. She got straight A's. She was just excellent, and I hated her. And, you know, because I'm always comparing how I feel to how you look, and she looks so much better than how I felt. And Linda got hit by a truck and killed. And when she got hit by that truck, it knocked her 200 feet, killed her. I remember going to the funeral home, and the ones that I picked out were the ones that said, you know, God must have wanted an angel. And I thought, so he hit you with a truck. I'll pass. Still do, you know. That's the God of my misunderstanding. I started getting information about a God that ripped people out of my life, that made babies starve in Africa, that just out to hurt me, just out to hurt me, because the ones I picked up in church, you're going to burn in hell, young man. Oh, I remembered that one. I forgot the 51 other sermons he gave about forgiveness and healing. I just remembered the ones where it made me feel awkward. Made me feel different, and then what would I do? I would resent them. And after a while, if you're a collector of ones like I'm a collector of ones, you start resenting everybody. I remember in church, there used to be one guy that sat up front here, and he always had thin blue lips, talked like this. And every Sunday, he looked so holier than thou sitting there, and I thought, you know, he looks so much better and like he was having so much fun last night at the bar, you know? Seemed to be a lot looser, having a little fun. I don't know who that grump is he's sitting with, but the chick last night was a lot more fun, too. And so I'd look at that guy and I think, man, he's an upstanding member of the church. What a hypocrite. Now, I know you're not this sick, but I am. I didn't only judge him and his family and that pew and that church. I judged entire organized religion by that one narrow-minded view. See, half the things I hated I made up in my own mind that had no basis in reality. My basic problem was the way I looked at things. And I really had to get close to that, and I really had to come to understand that. Because if you think coming to these programs and just not drinking or coming to these programs and not doing anything is the answer, you're in serious trouble. It's my opinion that you have to come to here and your life has to change. It's like a drill. Might as well use the sound effects. And when the drilling stops, you feel better. But you must drill. And I don't know about you, but when I came to the program, I was I resented two types of people, living people and dead people. Pretty much it. Everybody else was okay. But I really found something wrong with everything and everybody else. Everything and everybody else. And when I looked in the mirror, you know who I hated most? Me. Had to hate me because I'm the common denominator in everything. Common denominator in everything. If I am going to live a new life, and if I'm going to learn about forgiveness, I got to really understand that that means every area of my life. I've been reading a lot of different spiritual books lately, and not a lot, because I really love the most spiritual book. One of the most spiritual books in the world is the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went through seminary for 7 years, and believe me, after that, you don't want to read a lot more books. But I read some now, and the common thread is this. Thank God for everything that ever happened in your life. Whoa, back this truck up. What? Thank God for everything that ever happened in your life. Now, the thing I resented about God, this God of my misunderstanding, is God's responsible for everything. Every hair on your head. Well, he wasn't paying attention here. No? Every hair on your head, every bird that falls, every leaf, you know. And that's the one I remembered. I've got to really get to the point of where I'm learning to be reborn, what I started to read. What does reborn mean? Start a new life. One of the things that we've been granted in these programs of Al-Anon and AA is a reprieve. A new life sentence, if we'd like, of happy, joyous, and free. It's up to us. We can go whatever way we want. But it's a reprieve on a daily basis, and I have to find a relationship with God that's going to help me walk through there. And I have to start understanding that the way I think about things was a lot of my problem. And when it came to God, I had to start throwing out, there's an analogy I use a lot of times. When I was a little kid, I got a cooler full of fresh vegetables. And this cooler goes through life, and you get fresh vegetables, and you put fresh vegetables in. And somewhere along the line, I started collecting one, which are rotten vegetables. And I started putting them in the cooler, too, and you know what they did? They destroyed all the good vegetables. And I'd never clean out the cooler. And I'd go through life, and there'd be some good vegetables, bad vegetable. Destroy everything. And after a while, I no longer looked for good vegetables. I just saw the bad vegetables. And I was always surprised when I opened the cooler. And the smell disgusted me. And that was my innermost thoughts in my being. So you know what I did. I closed the cooler. What the steps of our program demand that we do is open up the cooler, clean it out, and acknowledge what's been in the cooler, whether it's been proper information or bad information. And on forgiveness, I found for me it was much easier to hate because that was familiar. It was familiar territory. I remember the time I called my sponsor, and I said, man, he said, I don't know what's going on today. Something's odd. And he said, Ed, he said, how's work? And I said, oh, good. He said, you going to meeting? Yeah. How's the people you sponsor? Oh, good. And I was married at the time. He said, how's the wife? I said, oh, good. He said, Ed, you know what's wrong? I said, He said, nothing. I went, oh, okay. I had no clue. Part of my perspective was, if my guts weren't rumbling, I wasn't living. If my guts weren't rumbling, that wasn't life. And I had to learn that it was okay to live in peace. Absence of conflict is called peace. I used to think if that rumbling stopped, if I gave it up, if I surrendered all this stuff, what am I going to be? Happy. Joyous and free. Happy, joyous, and free. The minute you give it up, that sense of nothing going on there is called a tremendous peace. And these 12 steps will help you to enjoy that one day at a time. It says in here about resentment. I'm trying to remember the page. I think I had it written down. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stems all forms of spiritual disease. For we have not only been mentally and physically sick, we have been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. Isn't that a great line? I always had that reversed. I always thought, you know, when I get to feeling better and get my head on straight, I'll tackle that God stuff. Here it says, when the spiritual malady is addressed, the mental and physical will take care of themselves. And that's what the steps helped me to do. Sounds like we're having group therapy back there now. And I think she's winning. Huh? Yeah, if you would. It's getting a little loud. I lost my place now. My name's Ed and I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to take a minute and forgive the folks in back. One of the things I hated about God is I felt he ripped a lot of people out of my life. I touched on that basically. And that was really tough for me. I had a guy come into my office. Well, first off, I need to tell you that my mother was an excellent griever. She could get every ounce of pain out of any situation ever. She used to call me up and said, Ed, you know what day it is today? And I said, no, Mom, what day is it? Said, it's the day Aunt Gracie died. And I said, Mom, Aunt Gracie died 10 years before I was born. She said, I know, I just thought you should be aware of it. And Mom had a rotten day every day at Gracie's anniversary. She had it planned out and I think was kind of looking forward to it. You know? And I had a guy walk into my office a few years ago and came into my office and it was on a Monday and he said, you know, Ed, he said, I'm really going to be depressed this weekend. I thought, well, at least you're planning them. That's good, you know. Thank God you have a plan. And I said, why are you going to be depressed this weekend? And he said, I'm going to the dentist and getting my teeth drilled. Yeah. No, he said, this Friday is the anniversary of my daughter's death. And he got so sad. And I said, oh, okay. And I said, well, let's do this. I thought and said a little prayer. And I said, Thursday night when you go to bed, put a picture of your daughter, your favorite picture, right by your bed. And when you wake up Friday morning, I want you to look at that picture and I want you to start celebrating every good memory you've ever had. Every curl, every kiss on the cheek, every smile, every hug, every giggle. And all day long, I want you to celebrate her memory and lift her up. And he kind of looked at me funny. I said, or you can make it all about you. He got mad and stormed out. And we both know why, don't we? He had 2 good weeks ago in the meetings. What's wrong? Oh, it's the anniversary of my daughter's death. I just don't know what I'm going to do. Had nothing to do with his daughter's death. It had to do with the inability to forgive and self-inflicted pain. There's a great story I love. Story about, and it's a true story. I tell it as a story, but it's an experience I watched on TV, but I tell it as a story. There was this guy here who worked with a lot of people, and this gentleman came, and he lost his son 4 years before and literally was sobbing every day. His heart was broken. He lost his son. Understand, I am not making fun of grieving here. I understand grieving. Since I've been sober, my father was murdered. A brother-in-law was killed in an accident. One brother-in-law committed suicide. Sister-in-law committed suicide. 2 brothers killed by drunk drivers. I understand. My mother watched my mother die of cancer. I understand sadness. And since I've been in the ministry, I've sat by the beds of countless people as they've left this room and gone into the next. So I understand grief. I'm not making light of that. But the story goes, son died, this man was crying for years, and he was sitting with this guy, and he said, okay, he said, are you a Christian? The guy happened to be a Christian. He said, okay, I want you to go along with me on this vision, okay? And the guy said, okay. He said, and the man, my heart just went out to him, because his heart was really broken. And he said, I want you to envision a long line of people gathered outside the pearly gates, and They're all sitting there with brilliant white robes, and as they go up to St. Peter, they light their candle, and as their candle lights, their face illuminate, and they just have this wonderful smile, and they walk through the pearly gates. He said, can you see that? And he said, yeah, I can see that. He said, okay, I want you to envision with me looking off to the left and seeing your son sitting over there on a bench all by himself. And he said, now I want you to ask your son a question and I will answer for your son. He said, are you willing to do that? And he said, yes. He said, ask your son, son, why are you sitting there? And he said, son, why are you sitting there? And his son said, Dad, every time I go and get my candle lit, your tears drowned it out. And I can't go through the gates. Sometimes our grieving keeps their memories from being free. And I think for me, most of the time, that kind of selfish grieving makes it all about me and nothing about them. I make it a point anymore not to remember. I can't tell you the day my mother died. I can't tell you the day any of my relatives died because it's not of importance to me. What's important is what they did while they were here. And I celebrate their life and their memory. And I made that change constantly. I had a 24-year-old brother. Name was John. John was my older brother by 5 years. And all the kids in my families were total screw-ups. You know? I'm not judging. I'm just merely reporting. And they were total screw-ups. And John was this wonderful guy who started screwing up, met this woman, went into the Navy, and loved it, became an aviational hydraulics mechanic, and just skyrocketed, was honor man of his class at Memphis Tech. Just everything he did was just wonderful, and he spent 2 tours in Vietnam, and he came home and had a wife and 3 babies and was on his way to Miramar Air Force, our Navy base there in, down by San Diego, and 3 drunk Marines come up over the hill doing 80 mile an hour. 3 drunk Marines who happened to be brothers, and they swung into his lane and hit him head on and killed him instantly, killed them instantly. And we buried him on December 24th at Rock Island Arsenal Cemetery with full military honors, from letters from President and Secretary of Navy saying the great loss they had experienced at the loss of my brother. And Christmases were miserable for years. And then one day I thought, why am I ruining all my December 24ths because of one? Why am I doing that? I have a choice in the matter. I didn't know that. I didn't have to say anymore, see that? God even ruined Christmas by taking my brother out. I didn't have to go there anymore. I could be happy, joyous, and free. And when I thought about my brother, it could be something kind and loving. Those are the things about forgiveness that I need to remember every single day. Every single day. I have come to believe this, that the higher power I've come to know and believe and love in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is kind and loving and good. Nothing but good. I believe if it isn't good, it isn't God. I don't have a God that plays intellectual games with me. I love those people say, oh, God's testing me. That's right. Stops the whole world. Just screw around with your day. That's pretty much it. You're that important. Yep. No, the world tests me a lot. The world tests me a lot, but God never tests me. He loves me too much. He doesn't play sick little games with me. And sometimes that I like to play with other people. January 19th of 1972, I was a little over a year sober. And I had been talking this stuff about a God pretty good. You know, it's kind of easy to do. It's hard to do, but it's easy to talk about. And I was talking so well that I had become so spiritual I was of no earthly good. And an unfortunate thing happened. My father was murdered He walked into a bar across the street, and he went over to get himself a quart of beer, and mom a bottle of pop, and five young men come in and just opened fire and shot everybody. Now, a significant thing happened on that night. I was over there for dinner, and for the first time in my life, my old man said something to me that I knew was impossible. You know, they say when you get sober, when you start working your program, miracles happen. God bless you, that's true. That's absolutely true. But this wouldn't even have made the miracle list. I was sitting at dinner that night, and Dad looked at me and said, "Just want to tell you that I'm proud of you, son." Would have never believed that happened. And right after, he walked into that bar. And I had a life where it was 20 years on the streets, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And you don't mess with my family at all. I got hit with every emotion you can possibly. If you've lost someone by murder, you know what I mean. September 11th gave you all an education in needless homicide and the horror of innocent people just being slaughtered. So you understand more now today than you would have before that day. But when it happens, it's a multitude of every emotion you can ever imagine. Every emotion you can ever imagine. You want to homicide, suicide, horror, anger. Everything, every emotion I've ever known hit me like a truck as I'm sitting there in the morgue seeing my father with that bullet hole in his face. And I reached for that faith I'd been professing, and I've come up with a handful of warm mush, because it was all nice words and none of my experience, none of my application in my steps of faith. But the kind and loving God surrounded me with the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, and they were my angels. And as soon as I walked out of that door, there were members of Al-Anon and AA there, and they didn't say much. They just looked at me, and I knew. And they knew I knew. And everywhere I went, somebody was there. And I felt safe in a place where I'd never been before. I remember having terrible feelings of wanting to even the score, this horror. How can you do this? How can I let this stand? I have a brother, Chuck, who was a three-time loser. He did a lot of hard time. Chuck was a mean guy. You'd never hear a threat. You'd hear a gun go off. That was his threat. And 6 months after I got sober, Chuck got sober. And I remember Chuck screaming up in front of the house with a load full of guns in the back of the car. And he said, "I know the neighborhood. I know where they're at. Let's go." And I know where this came from today. I didn't then. And I said, "Chuck, but for the grace of God, it wasn't you and I in there doing the shooting. Come on in the house. Mom needs us." That's an act of grace. That's an act of God. That isn't an act of Ed. And they caught the guys, and eventually, I had to go to trial. And I can remember walking in that courtroom, and I was a little annoyed walking in the courtroom because people in AA ruined that for me. They said, "Now, Ed, when you go to court, you got to behave." Well, I have never done that before, you know. Hell, when you go to court, that's when you create your reputation. And but I did what they said. I dressed up and I went to court, and I remember there was this guy sitting there, and I thought, you give me 5 minutes with him, we don't need a trial. In fact, bring all five of them in. We'll take care of this in short order. Now, the part I don't talk about much, I'm going to talk about now. For about the next 3 months, I would set up at night and I would plan their murder. I knew county jail inside and out. I was on good rapport with county jail. They let me come in there and talk to alcoholics all the time. And I worked through the court, and at that time we had a relationship with the court system that if somebody came in with a drug or alcohol problem, they just give them to us for 30 days and said, "We'll bring them back in 30 days and we'll see how they're doing." And I just loved it. So I was able to go in and out of that jail and just do whatever I wanted to do. And I used to sit up at night. And I used to think how to get even. And there were a couple old-timers around. Well, they were old-timers to me then. Whole 5-6 years, And I sat down with them, and one day I had to tell them how I was feeling, how these feelings of homicide and this feeling of rage and this feeling of anger, and they got up and walked away, and they said, I thought you had a good program. You can't be feeling that and having a good program. And they got up and walked away. Now, I've learned since then, by the way, they went out shortly thereafter, that I had a remarkable program because I was sitting there telling people the most horrid feelings I've ever had in my life. And I wanted to survive through them instead of react on them. Kent talked about it. I'll talk about it more in a minute. They got up and walked away, so I quit talking to people in AA pretty much. That brother I told you about, I buried him at 36 years old after 3 years sobriety, and he decided he could drink again. Last time I saw him, he was running all the massage parlors out in Orange County, California, down in Costa Mesa, and I had to borrow $5 to go see him because I was broke. Went down there, and he's driving a new Caddy and married one of his co-workers. She made me want to get a job, I'll tell you. And he's got this wad of cash that'd choke a horse in this new Eldorado sitting outside. And he said, Ed, come to work with me. He said, come to work with me. He said, if we get busted, you'll be in jail most a couple hours. We got everybody on retainer. And I'm so grateful for my sponsor because I went back and I could talk to him about that. I said, well, what do you think, But see, you laugh. He understood where I was coming from. It was a real decision I had to make. I'm sitting there, don't have gas money, and I've got a protected role and can make all the stuff that I ever thought would make me happy. And the only thing he ever said to me is, he said, Ed, he said, they're pretty tough on prostitution out here in California. He said, eventually they'll get you. And I said, okay. And I remember going and telling him, borrowing $5 to go down and tell him, drove down to Whittier, and he laughed at me. Because I said, Chuck, this time I've been sober, I got a little dignity and self-respect. And I said, I'd not only be selling my dignity and self-respect, I'd be selling the girls. And I just don't want to do that. And he laughed at me. He said, Ed, you've always been a loser. You're always going to be a loser. When I walked up to his casket at 36 years old, and I said my goodbyes, and I said, Chuck, you're wrong. I'm not a loser. This program's made me a winner. And I have no animosity toward him. You know why? Because of his anger, he couldn't get what's been freely given to us. He'd never forgive the same situation I'm talking about. I went to the courtroom, and I remember seeing those guys, and like I told you, and I was down at Scott County Jail one day, and I didn't mean to be. I was just there walking through, and they're bringing these guys out for sentencing, and I had no idea that they were there. And, of course, they recognized me, and they started bad-mouthing me and calling me all kinds of names. Now, for 6-8 months, I had been up nights thinking, you give me 5 minutes, I'll make it right. The jailer told him to shut up. They didn't shut up. Jailer told him to shut up again. They didn't shut up. He pulled his gun out, laid it right in front of me, and went in to shut him up. Up until that minute, I would have told you that I would have blown their brains out, not thought twice about it. And I thought that was the truth. When that happened, the strangest thing happened. The oldest one of these guys were 18 years old. And I remember what it was like the first time I went to jail. And I had this mouth going and this foul mouth going and all this going, and I cried myself to sleep at night. And I realized that that's what these guys are going to do the rest of their life. And instead of picking up the gun, I found myself saying a prayer for them. For them. Because I understand that kind of pain and I understand that kind of anguish. Now, I share that with you because Kent was talking about it a little in his talk this morning. I learned a very important lesson. It has to do everything with forgiveness, that my feelings are not facts. Just because I feel a certain way does not mean it's true. Months I thought, if I ever had the chance, by God, you put a lie detector on me, true. I'd get him, and I'm not a guy with a lot of talk. I mean, Wayne knows. In my area, I was a wild man. I was just a wild man. I'd take you out. I wouldn't care. But yet when the time come, I found out that's not what I felt at all. In fact, what I really felt when I took a moment was something that was unusual for me. It was called compassion. Compassion. Really, what was the difference between those guys and me besides a certain amount of alcohol, chemicals in the right situation or the wrong situation? What was the difference? Oh, they were murderers, yeah, much less than getting in a 3,000-pound bullet and driving down the freeway. Yeah, much less of a murderer, aren't they? No. No. I found out that my feelings weren't facts, and I found out that's step three, bondage of self. If I'm really going to forgive, I got to start challenging everything I've ever thought about the most difficult positions I've ever had. I hated my father. Hated my father. Why did I hate my father? Because he used to call me the dumb little SOB. And I'm sure you can figure out what that means. Now, that's all I remember about my dad. But what I need to tell you is Dad was one of the hardest working men I've ever known in my life. Mom used to tell the story about Dad that when he worked during the Depression shoveling coal, he got paid 25 cents per ton, and in a 20-hour day that he worked, he made $18. My old man could work. My old man didn't leave when times got tough, seven kids. I did, sober. But I didn't want to remember any of that. In fact, I didn't even know I knew any of that. Until I took a good fourth and fifth step. And I went back and I found out something that I didn't know. And I found out Kent's one too this morning. I was a parent abuser. We always talk about, mine was, oh, I was so abused. I had this. They whipped me with a belt. Well, they should have used a chain. You know? Honest to God, they should have used a chain. But it was always all about me and what they did to me. And when I started looking about what I did to them, I remember my mother, God bless her. She had seven kids. I was the baby. You can imagine my big brothers. But she would sit there and read scripture when the house was being torn down around her. And I used to think she was nuts. Now I understand that was her place of peace. She knew she was powerless. And after a while, she got exposed to Al-Anon, and thank you, God, for Al-Anon, because it saved my mother's sanity, because she always thought that our behavior was a result of her raising us. I'll tell you what my mother taught me. Same thing Kent's parents taught him. Be kind and loving. Treat other people as you treat yourself. I had a lot of prejudice in my head growing up, none that my parents ever taught me. I can remember... There was a black kid walking up the street, and I was in the house one day, and I opened the door, and I blurted out the N-word and laughed and turned around, and my mother caught me with her hand, and I ended up in that corner of the room. And she said, you listen here, young man. You remember one thing. You didn't pick your color. That's my mom. But I learned the hatred anyway. Now, how'd I get rid of that? You got to start looking at the reality in life. You know, when I got sober, there was a big guy named Tony McDowell. And Tony was the director of Inner City Parks in Davenport, Iowa. And I was about 2 months sober, and he said, Ed, why don't you come with me and help us? They were helping juvenile runaways. We had a connection that we could, if we could intervene with runaway kids and get them home with no police record. 80% to this day of juvenile runaways that are out there simply because they're too afraid to come home. We were the intermediaries to get them home, and the police would bring them to us, and we could intermediate with the families and talk them. And Tiny said, why don't you come live with me, Ed, and stay here and do this. And Tiny happened to be black. I remember when I was newly sober, there was a guy named Bobby P. And I used to walk to Bettendorf Group. It was about 5 miles down the street. Why did I walk to Bettendorf Group? I wasn't worthy of bothering you guys for a ride. And Bobby, at Thursday night meeting, said, "You want to ride home?" And I go, "No." He said, "No, no, come on." He'd insist on giving me a ride home. And he did that all the time. 2 years later, I found out that Bobby had dropped me off at Dawn Incorporated, is what it was. He'd get about two blocks, and the police would pull him over, strip search his car, and ask him what he was doing with me. They did that for about 6 months. And you know the only thing Bobby ever said to me on Thursdays? "Ed, you need a ride?" Bobby happened to be black. My hatred has no color. It's just something I spread over everything if I'm not real careful. And what I've got to learn to do is quit hating anything or anybody. You know, in our big book, it talks about anger. And it says it is the dubious luxury of normal people. They're not kidding. I used to process my anger. I was good at processing my anger. A guy reminded me about me processing my anger a while back. He said, "Ed, I haven't seen you in a number of years." I said, "No, how are you?" He said, "Oh, good." He said, "I remember the last time I was in a meeting with you." And I said, "Really, why is that?" And he said, "You knocked the guy out with one punch." I went, "Oh, God, no." I'm a spiritual guru, and I can't say that, you know. But indeed, I remember I was sitting there at a Thursday night meeting in L.A., and we have a tradition that you don't talk during participation. And there's this guy yapping away during the participation, and I tapped him on the shoulder. And I said, "Excuse me, you're making a lot of noise, and you can't hear the speaker." He said, "Oh, okay." And we have a 10-minute break out there, and at the 10-minute break, this woman said, this guy turned around to me and said, "Don't ever put your hands on me, man. Don't tell me to shut up. Don't." And I'm thinking I'm handling this rather well. And I'm saying, "No, you don't quite understand. I'm just trying to help you." And little Alice came over and said, "Big Ed, sit down, Big Ed." And I said, "Oh, honey, I'm fine. Don't worry. The guy and I are just talking. Don't worry." And we go back and we're talking some more. There again, here's Alice. "Big Ed, sit down. Big Ed, sit down." "No, no, Alice, don't worry." And I turned around and he said, "Don't you ever." And the next thing I know, he's flying over four rows of chairs. My first thought was, how am I going to explain this to my sponsor? But I knew what to do. I went around the four rows of chairs and I woke him up and made amends real quickly. Sponsored him for the next 5 years. He said he'd been slipping for quite a while. Nobody had ever gotten his attention. And they had. Now that all that's said, I need to tell you that there is no excuse most of the time for anybody laying anybody's hands on anybody in AA except when someone's in danger. And I've had to do that from time to time, but it made me look at me. Shortly after that, I was going out to Thousand Oaks to speak, and I was thinking in my spiritual talk, and this guy cut me off and said that I was number one and hit his brakes. And I don't know, maybe I cut him off. I don't know. I'm just driving down the street. And then he did my favorite thing out in L.A. Out in L.A., you can go out, get out and beat the hell out of each other. Nobody cares, you know. And am I wrong? No, this is great. I loved it. He made my favorite sign. He went, "Pull over." I thought, excellent. I've got a few minutes before my spiritual talk. Let's see. And he pulls over. It is Audi. And then he did my favorite thing. He got out of the car. Okay, he's coming at me. Anything's fair now. And I go out and I grab him by his crotch and his collar and I throw him over his car. And I thought, well, he probably shouldn't have done that, Ed. And I went around and I picked him up and I carried him back and I put him in his car. I was brushing him off. It was making amends for him. I'm a good member. You know, I'm a member of a 12-step program. What we do? Since I quit processing my anger, I haven't had any of those. I've got to give it up. I've got to give it up. I'll tell you this. Any anger I possess taints every relationship I have, especially the ones I love the most. Any anger I want to maintain or possess or feel self-righteous about takes away from the very people I love the most, just like alcohol did, just like anything else did. Why must I do that for freedom? It's not about being a goody two-shoes. It's about surrendering at depth and not being the martyr anymore. You know, I had to start looking at my life and understand that half the things I complained about, I used for my own benefit. I regret to tell you that there's a payoff for being the son of a murder victim. And you see them on TV every now and all the time now. They make pretty much careers out of it. And that anger and that loneliness and that despair, I see it all the time. And I pray for them because I know how that is. Not on that grand a scale, but going into meetings and somebody says, oh, you know, Ed's father was murdered. Oh, yeah. God, that makes me sick when I think about it. Especially that it went on for years and I didn't even know it. Oh, he was abused. Oh, I remember I walked up, I love that abuse. I was abused when I was 8 years old and I'm still looking for the woman. Well, I'm sorry, it's just the truth, you know. It was a wonderful experience. I thank God for it. And that is not politically correct, but I don't give a damn. They always say, and hopefully I'll run into her one day in these rooms. And all kidding aside, I know that was wrong, but for me, it was one of those times when somebody was gentle and caring to me, and I'd never had that before. Was it wrong? Of course it was wrong. Don't get me. But I mean, to feign guilt about it and work it for all I can get. You know, when I was in Job Corps at 16, it was 98% black and 2% white and Hispanic. A little different dynamics. And there were 2,500 guys there, and I got drugged and gang raped. Now, I can do a lot with that. That could keep me in therapy for years. And I was so naive, it took me a week to figure out what happened. Had no idea. I just know that my friends wouldn't talk to me anymore, and I was sore in places I'd never been sore before, and I was sick, and I couldn't figure it out. Now, I can do one of two things with that. I can keep it in, it can destroy me, or I can let it out here, and it don't own me at all. Because it wasn't my actions. It was their actions that were the problem. It was their actions that were the problem. I was down in Texas talking to this gal, and she came up to me after I talked. She said, I want to talk to you. And I said, okay, good. She said, I've hated my father for 56 years, and he's been dead for 20. And I said, well, why have you done that? I knew why, because I'd seen the mood before. Instead, well, he molested me. And I said, so you've kept the molestation alive this last 20 years, huh? And she looked at me and said, he's dead. You're keeping it reality. She said, I've never thought of it that way. I said, well, try thinking about it that way, because the way you're thinking about it isn't doing good. Then she said a great question to me. One of the best questions I've ever been asked. She said, okay, Mr. Smarty Pants. She didn't say that, but I knew she was thinking. She said, what if I die and go to heaven and he's there? I thought, God, what a great question. What if I die and go to heaven and he's there? And like that, God gave me the answer. He said, wouldn't that be the exact place you'd want to meet him? Because if he's in heaven, he's known what he's done, and he's asked from the bottom of his heart for forgiveness, and he knows the way he broke your heart. What better place to meet him? See, half of my anger and fear of today was dying. And I'm not afraid of dying anymore because of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. About 4 years ago, I was taken to the doctor. I used to go up in the North Woods and chop trees down in the winter. God, I just loved it. It was North Woods, and there was 380 acres and one cabin. It was just great. And I went down twice with chest pains. Of course, I finished chopping the wood. And I went to my doctor when I got back home. And I remember the doctor run some tests for like a month. He did all kinds of stuff and radioactive stuff and tipped me on my head and took pictures and did all that. And one night he called me in. It was on a Monday night. And he said, Eddie, he said, I need you in here in the hospital at 5 a.m. in the morning. He said, you've had a major heart attack and you've got some real problems. She said, bottom of your heart is not too good and the top of your heart isn't any better. We need you in here at 5 and we're going to see what we can do, angioplasty, but I'm going to have heart surgeon stand by. He said, you're not in real good shape. And I said, okay. He said, I want you to go home and I get your affairs in order. I said, okay. And he said, Ed, do you understand what I'm telling you? I said, yeah. And he said, Ed, do you understand the magnitude of what I'm telling you? I said, yeah, you're threatening me with heaven. And he kind of looked at me. I said, you don't get it, Doc. If I've ever been close, it's now. I ain't afraid of that anymore. Why I ain't afraid of that anymore is because I don't live the way you live when people go to hell. Now, does that mean perfection? No, but it's better than I've ever been. You taught me that. Half of my fear and unwillingness to forgive is because I'd get caught and I'd get sentenced to hell. What I found out is when I decide to forgive and time to heal, it gives me a sentence to heaven. And that's what I believe. And I believe you can experience heaven right here on earth. I was preaching on forgiveness about 4 years ago in a church. I became a pastor along the way, and I realized that halfway through the sermon I hadn't told the guys who killed my father that they were forgiven. See, I've come to the belief that steps 8 and 9 are about repairing that damage, not this damage. It ain't about me. It's about what I did. And only half the amend was there because I had forgiven them, but I hadn't done the major part, and that's told them. Otherwise, it's all about me. And I stopped right in the middle of that sermon, and I said, you know, I'm going to find these guys that killed my father and let them know that they're forgiven. And a few weeks later, one of the guy's sentence was overturned. You want to know how well these steps work? You aren't going to believe this, because I find it hard to believe. I couldn't remember the names of the guys who killed my father. Talk about a justified resentment. You could keep anger forever, but it was of no use to me anymore. I couldn't remember the names of the guys who killed my father. But one of the guy's sentence got overturned. And the press came to me, and they said, Ed, what are you going to do? What do you think? And I said, well, it's time to heal. It's time to start new. Let him come home. Because it had been 27 and a half years. And they said, Ed, he went in there when he was 17. Where is he going to live? How is he going to make a living? Where is he going to stay? And I said, he can come live with me if he'd like. And they were taken back by that, and I'm not sure why. I'm really not sure why. You allowed me into these rooms. Why wouldn't I allow you allowed me into your home? I know what I was like. How dare I not allow him into mine and grant him the same gifts you've given me? And that's a good meal and a place to stay and a few extra bucks if he's a little broke. That story went all over the world. I got letters from Oprah, 2020, 48 hours. Al called and said, how'd you do that? I said, well, you see, it's step 8 and 9. If you're really working it, I found myself 2.5 weeks later walking down a prison cell in that prison that my brother Chuck spent so much time in that I swore I'd never go in again. Walking down that prison hall into a cell and sticking out my hand, greeting a guy I hadn't seen in 27 and a half years. Last time I saw him, I thought, we don't need a trial. Let me have him. Let me have all 5. We won't need a trial. And I found myself sticking out my hand and saying, Sherman, my name's Reverend Ed Mutum, and I'm here to tell you that God loves you and I love you, and he forgives you and I forgive you. And if there's anything in my life I can ever do to help you in any way, allow me to do that. And he looked into my eyes and he saw something that you guys put there. And you showed me how to, it had always been there, but you showed me how to illuminate it. And that's the love of God that's in each and every one of us. And he knew I was telling the truth. It's not about being a goody two-shoes. It's about time to heal. And we talked for 2.5 hours, and it was amazing because at the end of that 2.5-hour talk, we all joined hands and said the Lord's Prayer, and there wasn't a dry eye in the place. The warden was there, the attorneys, the state attorney general, and a lot of healing took place that day. Now I want to ask you that's here today, what do you need to leave here? What have you been hanging on to that's been killing you? What good is it doing? you, your children, your loved ones, what good is it doing? If it isn't doing any good, I'd ask you to leave it here today. And even if you think it's doing a little bit of good, I'd ask you to leave it here today. Now, did I do that because I'm some amazing human being? I'm average at best. But these steps make us all amazing human beings. It helps us to do things that were totally impossible. Sherman eventually came home, lived with me. I got him a place to stay, got him several jobs, got him bought him clothes, did everything I could. I did everything you had done for me. And then he fell in love, and I haven't seen him since. And I understand that, too. Because he owes me absolutely nothing. He didn't owe me anything going in. What I owed him was an apology. Do we have questions written out? Did we get any? We got a few more minutes. It's supposed to go to what, 12:15 or 1:15? 1:15. Are there any questions that were written out?
Any questions, I'll come get them.
I think I've answered every question. Okay, I want to close with something that may sound familiar to you, but I would ask you as I read this, if you don't think forgiveness has anything to do with our programs, listen to this. Close your eyes and talk to the God of your understanding for a moment while I read it. Lord, make me a channel of thy peace, that where there is hatred, I may bring love. That where there is wrong, I may bring the spirit of forgiveness. That where there is discord, I may bring harmony. That where there is error, I may bring truth. That where there is doubt, I may bring faith. That where there is despair, I may bring hope. That where there is sadness, I may bring joy. Lord, grant that I may seek rather to comfort than to be comforted, to understand rather than to be understood, to love than to be loved. It is by self-forgetting that one finds, and it is by forgiving that one is forgiven. It is by dying that one awakens to eternal life. Amen. Thank you all for coming. There's no questions. No, anybody got a question that you're not afraid to ask? Yes. Good. Gotcha. Here's how I work. Excellent question. Here's how I work on self-forgiveness. I don't get into the, oh, it's all about me thing. You know, the therapy is a wonderful thing. It just makes a lot of people I know very crazy. But for the self-forgetting, what I do is I had to, and I charge you all here to do this. I charge you all here right now to do this. Some of you are probably doing it. A lot of you maybe. But I charge you to do this. I want you to start treating yourself as if you actually liked you. I want you to start treating yourself the same way you would treat someone you actually love and respected. If you do that, then the things and mistakes we've made in our life, we understand that we are just other children of God doing the best we can. I don't call it self-esteem. I call it God esteem. It's the goodness in me finding the goodness in you. So that's how I, if you will, self-forgive. I remember that I am a child of God and I have the right to be here. And that God's right here, always has been, never left. And if God thinks I'm worthy of being here, then I got to agree with him rather than me. Okay? Any other questions? Good question. Let's just close with the Serenity Prayer. Yep.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.